Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc. All rights reserved.
We're back. It's 12 after. Thank you for joining us. Thank you for hanging around this morning. 800-531-3815. Toll free, coast to coast, 800-531-3815. Rich Salmon is our guest. Rich is an editor with the Kiplinger Editors, and he's an old friend of ours, sitting in for Joan Pride today. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Yes, thank you very much, Jim. Glad to be with you.
It's good to have you back. Appreciate you sitting in for Joan, and she's a little under the weather, but we're I think she's on the mend now. You guys got a great letter out this week, and let's get right into it, Rich. The you guys say that the president's tax plan is a big time tax reform, and it's actually got a little bit of a subliminal message almost. It's actually trying to shift taxing from to spending from income, and that's kind of a major shift there, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. There's a lot going on, and the tax plan, which is submitted part of his budget, and if you recall, part of his State of the Union address, the whole idea is to remove taxes on dividends, and also to create these special savings accounts. But really, when you look at it, and it does face a tough road ahead. But when you look at it, it's really a backdoor approach into a total change and overhaul into the U.S. tax system, and slowly going to a consumption tax, mm-hmm. and removing taxes on wages and salaries.
Yeah, and it's I read that the other day, and in another place, in addition to Kiplinger, and I guess I didn't see that coming. Although I've spoken many times. In fact, three or four years ago, I did quite a few shows on the different kinds of tax, the different tax proposals, the national sales tax, the flat tax. I've had a lot of people on the show talking about that before.
Right.
But apparently, as you know, Rich, if you just started focusing on, and as people did 4 years or so ago, if you just started saying we want to go to a flat tax, we want to go to a VAT tax or a national sales tax, approaching it from that standpoint really didn't work. It fell flat on its face.
Well, I've been in the Ways and Means Committee and the Senate Finance Committee and speaking with the chairman, and it's very difficult to do anything that large in a sweeping manner. You can't just go to a consumption tax.
Right.
First of all, you have lobbyists from all these different industries who have all of these different protections in the mm-hmm. current tax code, and secondly, it requires a immense amount of public support, and that really isn't where the public is right now.
Right.
While we're all tired of being taxed, there is not the overwhelming sense and public decry that we need to go to a consumption tax right away. Nevertheless, it is certainly a compass heading of this administration to have a major impact and change on the tax code. It was very much the case with Paul O'Neill, mm-hmm. the Treasury Secretary, who is now retired, resigned.
Right.
but yes, you pick the word, whatever you want. And so. I think if he were still there, that the push would be on to push this even harder. However, I think it is reflective of Bush's overall attitude about taxes, that the more you can get people to save and take the taxes and off of earnings.
To save and invest.
Yeah.
To save and invest.
Save and invest, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Take it off of that and put it on consumption. And, you know, I agree. And there's one other motive in here that we can never lose sight of, and that's that along with what we were just talking about, hopefully you're going to get tax simplification.
Tax simplification, right. And tax simplification may be another term that is used as sort of if you don't mind, a backdoor approach towards changing a lot of it.
Yeah. Well, these things have got to be changed by degree because, as you say, I mean, you just don't, as you've probably heard somebody say before, you just don't eat a hog like this all at once. You got to take it one leg at a time.
Right, but then that also becomes difficult too because how do you change it just bit by bit? It seems to me like you would need to go to a consumption tax all of a sudden instead of saying, okay, we're going to reduce taxes on this amount of income, but at the same time we're going to raise sales taxes by a certain degree. It just seems like it would be easier to do it.
It would, from a mechanical standpoint, you're exactly right. But the problem we have with making tax changes, with tax reform, Rich, is not the mechanical part. It's the cultural part,
right?
And the political part.
There's two parts of tax changes that's very difficult for Congress to even touch, and one is mortgage interest on houses, and the other is charitable donations.
Those two things will pretty much have to be fixed. But now look at this though, Rich. Look at what happened in the 80s. You know, there were four or five different, or probably at least four different tax bills that were passed in the 80s, and for a long time, the sacred cow in that was deductions for real estate investment,
right,
and being able to leverage that as with what was called the at-risk provisions. In other words, you could actually deduct real estate losses for which you were not at risk. And people thought that we'd never lose that. You know, we lost the at-risk provisions for cattle, we lost it for R&D, we lost it for metals, for R&D, for exploration, that sort of thing. We lost it for that, but the last one to go was the at-risk provisions for real estate, but with the Tax Reform Act of 86, after about four or five of those, it finally went away. And so you got to take these things by degree in this country because the cultural issues, in my opinion, and the politics are going to prevent it from being done all at once.
Very well said, yes. Certainly, things take time. They don't happen overnight. And I believe that with this Congress, there is so much on their plate, Jim.
Yeah.
We're looking at the prospect of an invasion of Iraq.
Yeah.
And the economy is sort of sputtering along. And I don't know if there is the immediate gratitude, if you will, for an idea of cutting taxes further when the deficits are growing.
I think you're right. Mr. Bush has got an uphill climb, no question about it. Stand by, Rich. We're going to take a quick break, folks. 20 after. We'll be right back with our friend Rich Salmon right after these messages. We're back. It's 23 after. My website is www.jpsba.com. Check it out when you can, and don't forget to subscribe to my newsletter when you get there. It comes every week by email. Rich Salmon is our guest. He's senior associate editor with the Kiplinger Editors, and we're talking about the most recent Kiplinger letter. And, Rich, we were just talking about what the president's plan is, what his intention is. He's trying to get taxes removed from dividends. He wants to make taxes removed from savings, and he's trying real hard to make that happen, but he's kind of up against a little bit of a brick wall, isn't he?
Well, he really is, and one thing to keep in mind, when he doesn't get what he wants, which is the removal of taxes on dividends, and also the great increase in these savings accounts, the opponents say, well, that's really just another way of helping the more wealthy people, because not everyone is going to max out on what they can save each year. Mm-hmm. And when you do this, and then when you take the dividends away, well, who really gains from dividends? People who tend to have, the stocks, and when you look at the macro picture, they tend to be wealthier types. When he doesn't get all of that, and then add to that the problems with the deficit and the disinclination of many to make the deficit hole worse, when you're also looking at the cost of a war with Iraq, Middle East, and occupation costs.
Mm-hmm.
What might happen is that you would have a more stimulus-related bill. and that could have a lot of effect for small businesses. So there could be small business elements of this bill that are then increased when other things are dropped. Mm. And that could be something that we see when the bill is later done through conference through the House and Senate here, so before it's actually signed into law. But there could be things like much larger expensing deductions, things like
from,
that.
From your mouth to God's ears, Rich.
Yes.
But I will tell you this. I did think that the president, I like the president's approach. I like his concept. I like the way he thinks in terms of the macro plan. But in terms of focusing on small business, $75,000, being able to deduct $25,000 in small businesses, which is what we can do today, thanks to a lot of good organizations who have put pressure on our government, and I've mentioned them many times before in the past, because of some of those folks who've worked hard on that, we can now expense $25,000 a year, which is a big deal to small business. But for most small businesses, being able to deduct $75,000 a year is more than we need. And so even though it sounds good, there are a lot of small businesses that won't help. We need to be a little more creative in the way we spend that money.
Okay, very well. Yeah.
If you see what I mean. Because, see, if you think about it, $75,000 in capital items purchased in a year is a lot of purchases. And we may do that this year, but we probably won't do it 2 or 3 years in a row.
Now,
the larger companies, mid-sized companies, they may do that. But that's something we need to take that money in. I would try to help them be a little more creative. But the other thing that's going on is the Democrats, obviously, are going to try to prevent the president from accomplishing this. But we've also got to stop spending. Rich, we've got to realize that we can't. One of the things I get the idea that some of the politicians are unhappy about is not that they're not so much unhappy that that we're not going to get that they don't want us to get our money back in the form of tax refunds and tax reform, but the fact that that's going to mean that they're not going to be able to spend all that money for us.
Jim, it's an amazing question. Very good that you asked. There's about a 4% increase expected in discretionary spending, as they call it. I know it's like a Washington term, but it's the most telling story about Washington. You have these lawmakers; they spend a good part of their career just trying to get elected. Then they get elected. Then they're freshmen; they have very little say on anything. Mm-hmm. Then they kind of rise through the ranks. They get on the Appropriations Committee. Finally, then they realize that they have to say of about 33 cents on the dollar. That is what discretionary spending is. And so that's where it becomes very stark and real that two-thirds of the budget, 67 cents on the dollar, is automatic entitlement spending. It's Medicare, Medicaid.
Can't touch it.
Social Security, veterans benefits, and interest on the debt. Sometimes I wonder what the forefathers would have thought when they established in their glorious manner at the Constitutional Convention to realize that 225 years later that people would be elected to Congress to pretty much decide 33 cents on the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
Everything else is automatic spending.
Yeah, it's hard to believe. And what are we going to do about that, Rich?
All you can do is go into the laws themselves and change them to affect the way that the spigot puts the money out from the federal treasury. So that requires Social Security reform, requires Medicare reform, Medicaid reform, and they are awfully difficult to do. Certainly, you could have a chairman saying, yes, we will definitely do this. We will address it this year.
Yeah.
Well, then you realize you're talking about a lot of retirees or soon-to-be retirees who are expecting benefits. And
don't forget the demographic issues.
Right.
My generation, there are 80 million of us. We're going to live longer than our parents did, and the generation behind us is only 30 million. I mean, just the demographic, the sheer numbers will tell you that we've got a problem, let alone the mechanics of the system itself. Stand by. We're going to take a quick break. 29 after. We'll be right back. The show is brought to you by IBM and Office Depot.
now celebrating 5 years of burning up the airwaves.
If I were the man I was 5 years ago, I'd take a flamethrower to this place.
You're listening to the voice of small business.
This is Dr. Fraser Crane. I'm listening.
He's Jim Blassingame, the small business advocate.
We're back. It's 34 at the hour, 800-531-3815, toll-free coast-to-coast. Rich Salmon is our guest, sitting in for Joan Pride. Rich is senior associate editor with the Kiplinger Editors, and their weekly letter, folks, is the one that we work off of every week. We cover it a few days after it first comes out. The Kiplinger Letter, now in its 80th year, is one of four publications that they publish on a weekly or biweekly letter. This was weekly. Then they have the three biweekly letters, which are the tax letter, the agriculture letter, and the California letter. And then they've got an outstanding magazine called the Kiplinger Personal Finance Magazine. And Rich, give us your website, and do you remember the phone number where they can subscribe?
Yes, I believe so, Jim. Yeah, the Kiplinger has a lot of products, and a lot of it is about doing better and getting better. Mm-hmm. And certainly with the Kiplinger letter, what we try to do is provide informed judgment and forecast. And so what we talk about with the Kiplinger letter is very much forward-looking stories about where we think the world is headed. And it's not only in personal finance, but also about the world in general and business and the marketplace and labor trends and the economy. And so you can check everything out at kiplinger.com. And you can also preview the Kiplinger letter at kiplingerforecast.com.
All right. And then also, yeah. if you got the toll-free number where they can subscribe, you can subscribe online at that site, ladies and gentlemen, but you can also call this number. Do you have that number, Rich?
Yes. One is at area code 202-887-6400.
All right. Sounds good. And, folks, they also have the 30-day free trial that we now call the Blassingame 30-day free trial. So check that out when you get a chance. I worked hard to get you that discount. So don't forget to ask for that. They'll let you look at their publications for a month and try it out before you have to pay.
Jim, Rich, you're an advocate for so many people, including us.
That's right. That's right. I try to make sure my people get good deals. I work hard for their money. Okay, let's move over to page two and talk about the job growth. Now, one of the things that I've been a little bit excited about, Rich, was the fact that it looked like job growth picked up a little bit in January, but you guys kind of hit me with a wet blanket this week.
Yeah, be careful about what you read there on the business pages about strong signs in job growth. We do expect the economy to come back, but jobs will always lag behind other stronger signs in the economy. And that's it's historical. It's something we've come to know that the last sign of an economic recovery is when the number of jobs goes up significantly and unemployment goes down. What you saw last month was fairly misleading. It was a nice spike in the jobs number, but it was sort of distorted, and it was caused by shifts in the retail industry and mm-hmm. hiring there. We expect growth will remain sluggish until the Iraq situation is resolved.
So many things, unfortunately, Rich, are going to remain sluggish until that's resolved. But the good news is. There's a lot of compression of time here in getting something done, because if we don't, as we'll talk a little bit later on, whatever's going to happen is going to happen in the next, probably the next 30 to 45 days. And so hopefully we'll get this thing, we'll get you know, something done one way or the other, and maybe the economy can get back on track. Let's move on down and talk about healthcare. And this is very interesting. You guys say that there's going to be a new way to judge healthcare agencies in the future.
Yeah, when you think about home healthcare agencies, the government has planned to rate the quality of care of such agencies in all states probably by next year, by 2004, mm-hmm. that 10 areas of care that are provided in home, including the management of pain and medications and the rate of a hospitalization. So you could have an idea, sort of like judging a car and reading consumer reports about a car. you might be able to do the same thing with healthcare agencies. Just how good are they? How effective are they? What are the complaints?
That's good news, because that'll put a little pressure on people to make sure they do a good job if they know that we know how to evaluate them.
Right, and then if you imagine a few years down the road, the same thing should be happening about hospitals in general.
Right.
So, and that's no different than going to a supermarket.
Right.
Whether it's Acme or Safeway.
Right.
You want to have an idea. Well, how good are the services?
Stand by, Rich. We'll take a quick break, folks. We'll be right back with Richard Salmon. And when we do, we got a couple more things to talk about on healthcare. And then we're going to move on to talk about some stuff. One of the things is the NASA future, the future of NASA. Stay with us. We're back. It's 17 till. Guess what, folks? Valentine's Day is coming up. And I've got four ladies lined up, one right after the other, to do the show with me on Valentine's Day. Barbara Weltman, who's our tax expert, Grace Marie Turner, who is our healthcare expert, Barbara Luttrell, who is our Women in the Marketplace expert, and Cherie Carter-Scott, who is our love expert. She wrote the book called If Love is a Game, These Are the Rules. So I'm going to have a lot of fun with four Valentines tomorrow on the show. I'm looking forward to that. So we'll talk about a lot of different things, but we're going to intermingle a little bit of love all during the day. Rich Salmon, I'm not going to ask you to be my Valentine.
Okay, Jim.
But you are my friend, and I appreciate that very much. Let's hit one more.
We can always say that we will be contemporaries.
There you go.
Yeah.
You're such a sweet talker, Rich. I bet that goes a long way with the girls, doesn't it? I bet you're a hit at parties, aren't you, Rich? Let's talk one more quick thing on healthcare, and then let's move on. At the bottom there, you guys mentioned at the bottom of page two, retiree healthcare benefits will be paired by many companies. And these companies are having difficulty actually staying in business, and they've created all these defined benefit plans, haven't they, where they basically adopted these retirees for life, and the people just keep living, don't they?
Yes, and you were mentioning earlier, Jim, that demographics, we're all getting older, and we're going to be living longer. And certainly one of the reasons that we're living longer is to listen to the Small Advocate program on radio.
That's right.
But another reason is just general health. I mean, we're healthier, and so the average age is extending. And when that happens, you can't wonder why some companies are sort of scratching their heads and saying, gosh, we're just being drained.
Right.
By retiree healthcare costs, and healthcare costs can go up 15-20% in a year. And
it's
so, how many times?
It's gone up. It's gone up to double digits 3 years in a row.
3 years in a row.
Yeah, 10, 11, and 12% 3 years in a row.
And 12%. And so, how many times can you do that? Can you have those double digit increases before it just breaks the bank?
Yeah. They are
truly unsustainable.
Yeah.
It's not as if those kind of costs can be reinterpreted, looked at a different way, swept
right.
under the rug. You just can't have it.
And it's not like those companies are being mean either. I mean, they just literally can't keep going. So it's something we all need to be prepared for. It's another part of this entitlement crisis that we've got really in this country that a lot of people aren't really focusing on. We've got to try to focus on it. Let's move over and talk about something completely different. Rich, let's talk about NASA's future. You guys
right.
did a whole section on that this time.
Yes, sir. And so NASA is going through a long and difficult self-inspection about safety, but about the future of manned spaceflight. Of course, it is brought on by the disastrous loss of the Columbia.
Right.
And it's a worthwhile exercise, because although it's a tragedy that brought about it, there's an awful lot to look at NASA. We spend about $14 to $15 billion a year on NASA, and that's about the same as what we spend on foreign aid. It's not a large part of the budget, but then we're talking about a $2 trillion budget. So What are we really getting the best that we can for $15 billion? And I think the previous generation was sparked by the moon landing missions, the Apollo missions, and now we have the space station, which frankly does not really spark the same kind of interest and enthusiasm and national pride as did the moon landings. However, there's still a lot of stuff done there. There's a lot of science done in the space
station. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so we at Kiplinger feel that the manned space missions will continue and that NASA will be shut down for about a year.
Hopefully after we get our astronauts off the space station up there.
Right. There are three astronauts up there, and they very well may come down in a Soyuz craft.
Right.
Which essentially, the three up there, you slip into it, kind of undock from the station, and come down over land. It's not as complicated as a space shuttle.
Right. Yes. It's a lot simpler. Well, the thing about it, Rich, I'm convinced that we're going to continue manned space flight, and we need to. In my opinion, not doing it is tantamount to protectionism. I think the United States cannot afford to become protectionists. We've got to realize we live in a global marketplace now, and we can't pull our horns in and just live inside of our borders. And neither can we now pull our horns in and live inside of our gravitational field. I think we've got to explore. I think we've got to reach out to to do some things that are beyond our borders, our gravitational borders, Rich, because one of the things is that look at all of the benefits that we've derived from that not only have we, you know, I know they cost money, but the thing is we've already gotten our money back on a lot of them, and look at the generations to come that will benefit from these things.
Absolutely, Jim, and we believe in the same respect. There's a lot of commercial spin-off from the whole space missions, and it's not just one or two things. You know, everyone tends to think Velcro.
Right.
Something like that. That, you know, it came from the space missions. Well, yes, it's true, it did. And people buy it all the time. It's used everywhere.
Right.
And many, many other things, too.
Yeah. Rich Stammen, stand by. Folks, Rich is senior associate editor with the Kiplinger Editors. He and I will be right back to wrap up the hour right after these messages. 10 till Marshall Tucker will take us out. Until Rich Stammen is our guest, sitting in for Joan Pryde. Joan will be back next week. Rich, we appreciate you being part of our day today.
Glad to be with you.
Let's move on down and talk quickly about a little bit about Japan. Japan is such an interesting study, Rich. You guys report that they're going to have some continued hard times over there, and they're so interesting over there because I don't know if you saw this recently, but they've got a demographics challenge over there.
Oh, they do. Yeah, and for so many times after, so many years after World War II, Japan was a sort of a model of economic expansion. And now, for a decade or longer, it's been a model of economic contraction.
Right.
And so when you keep that in mind, look at Japan through that prism of an economically idle place. There are investment opportunities all over the place,
mm-hmm.
And so if you're patient, if you have the wherewithal to be a little patient and think about Japan as a place to expand, you can profit from consolidation of sectors that are in difficult straits. And so there are different types of firms already making inroads into Japan that a few years ago have not. However, there are firms that are ready to wait for a few years to see it all come back to pick the fruit off the tree. It tend to be financial services right now.
Yeah, but I'll tell you what's going to happen, what I'm afraid is going to happen in Japan. If they finally get their act together, they got major banking problems over there. They got demographic problems because, you know, we were talking about some of the problems we've got here with our entitlement crisis, Rich. They've got one over there, too, very similar because their birth rate has gone down. They actually have a negative birth rate now.
Really?
Yeah. And they've got, I think the average family over there is having 1.3 children, and that's not creating enough people to contribute to the entitlement programs that they've got in the future. And so they've got a major problem. And what I'm concerned about, though, is if they finally get their banking straightened out, and which is a huge, huge problem. It's one of the biggest financial crises in on the planet. If they ever get it straightened out, about that time, China will be really coming into its own and will probably neutralize them. I mean, just literally wash over them economically like an economic tsunami, and basically render them. I believe that they could easily render Japan basically just marginal.
Isn't that something? Well, that's a bold forecast, and if you do look at the demographics, there is something startling about that. You know, for a country on an island,
right,
that has a declining birth rate next to a continent that is expanding in Goliath manner. Yes.
Well, see, the United States is going to be, and this is off the literal, but the United States is going to have its own challenges. China could wind up being one of our great customers, and then ultimately, hinder our own survival from an economic standpoint if we don't learn how to partner with them properly. But Japan, I actually am not convinced. I wouldn't argue with somebody if they told me that Japan was basically, as an economy, even though it's the second largest economy in the world, if it wasn't basically in major problems, headed for major problems in the future. Rich, let's move on over and talk about some other stuff. Let's talk about Iraq a little bit. That's on page 4. What are your thoughts on Iraq right now?
Well, I believe that you said at the outset of the program, Jim, that 30-45 days is what you might expect. There's so many things that are on hold until this is over with, which almost makes the Iraq invasion a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Mm-hmm.
That there's so many people expect it to happen, that the economy is still right now because businesses don't know if they want to make big investments because they don't know what's going to happen, and politics is kind of on hold right now. And you have these Democratic presidential candidates, and they don't really know what to talk about. No one wants to talk about anything but Iraq and the prospect of terrorism.
It's occupying all of our minds right now, isn't it?
Well, it's consuming. It's all consuming. And that's part of what oddly makes the invasion, in my opinion, sort of self-fulfilling inevitability, that it almost has to happen because everyone expects it to happen. Certainly, I don't discount the idea that there could be a exile of Saddam Hussein, and that we don't need to go to war. However, when you have 150,000 troops set to go, they're not there to loiter.
But Rich, they'll be needed to take care of things afterwards, and that's another reason we need to realize they don't have to be there for an invasion. They could just be there for peacekeeping. Rich Salmon, thank you for being here. Good job today. We'll see you next time. Rich Salmon, ladies and gentlemen, with the Kiplinger Editors. I got to go for this hour. Before I do, I want to thank my heroes, small business owners. This is Jim Blasingame, the Small Business Advocate, and this program is for you.
Insperity presents the Small Business Advocate Show with Jim Blasingame. This is a copyrighted production of Small Business Network, Inc., intended for the private use of our audience. Except as otherwise provided by copyright law, all other copying, redistribution, or publication without prior written consent is prohibited. All rights reserved.